From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio. Focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Appreciate you all being with us on the Bishop's Hour. This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. And we are just glad, thrilled, excited to welcome in John Gassaway, who is a writer for EWTN and also an adjunct professor teaching basketball analytics at the prestigious Columbia University in the city of New York. And John, welcome to the Bishop's Hour.
Thank you, Bob. It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
You know, I was watching, like a good Catholic, I was watching the Gonzaga USF basketball game. I think it was Saturday or Sunday of last week. And they mentioned your book, Miracles,
yeah.
Miracles on the Hardwood. And I said, I've got to get a hold of this. And next thing I know, here I am talking to you.
Yeah, it pays to have work colleagues announcing Gonzaga games.
Isn't that nice?
they get out there and they push the product, yeah. So yeah. I owe Fran Frischilla lunch. No, that was very kind of him.
So and, that was Fran, and who was doing the play-by-play?
I think it was who was it? I think it was John Chambi, I think.
I think that sounds right. Yeah.
Fran called him the wrong name during the telecast.
I remember they went kind of back and forth about that, and they talked about somewhere else when he was working with Walton or something, and
exactly,
he said, "Yeah, you called me Joe or something."
Right. Yeah. But Fran actually has, or at least I sent him an advance copy. I trust that he read it or portions of it, so hopefully he knows whereof he speaks. But that was. That was a nice gesture. No surprise. He's a class act all the way. And I was, I too was watching, and I was thrilled to see that. So that was the promotion has started, and it doesn't even come out for another couple months.
I was gonna say. So is the book actually out? Out or anything?
No, the release date is March 16th. But I encourage everyone to. Go online wherever you choose to buy your books. You can pre-order it right now, and it'll be coming your way on that day, March 16th.
March 16th, in addition to being one day before St. Patrick's Day, and St. Patrick being the patron saint of the Diocese of Sacramento, along with Our Lady of Guadalupe, that sounds suspiciously like maybe the first weekend of March Madness or the final weekend of conference championship tournaments.
Yeah, it's going to be nestled right in there.
Yeah.
I don't have my calendar in front of me, but we did learn this week that the NCAA is shooting for a full-sized NCAA tournament on more or less a normal schedule. And if you've been paying attention this college basketball season, you know that we're not necessarily getting every game in, but we're getting more or less about 4 out of every 5 games played. And the tournament will be entirely in the state of Indiana. And, the book will be coming out at just that time, possibly right after Selection Sunday and before the round of 64 has been played.
So you're going to bring, generally it's 68, right? Including
68 teams, yeah.
And exactly. They're going to bring all 68, including those first four, all the way to Indianapolis or...
Yeah, it's actually Indianapolis and the surrounding area, places like Purdue,
uh-huh.
Indiana University, Ball State University, but a lot of it within Indianapolis proper. That's the NCAA's plan, and I hope they pull it off because a full-scale, full-size NCAA tournament, that would be, if we can do it safely and with everybody staying healthy, that would be worth seeing. We missed out on it entirely last year, and that would be we're seeing in 2021.
So, under a normal format, you would play Thursday. If say the first week, you play Thursday, Saturday, or Friday, Sunday. Will they have the same gap? Like almost a week or 5 days before you play again in the what would be the round of 16?
Right. That's what they're trying to pull off. That's what they're intended.
Wow.
You know, safely ensconced in their hotels in Indianapolis and play more or less a normal schedule. Now, if you're a fan of a given college basketball team and you've pulled for them in the NCAA tournament, you know that the math here is ruthless, and what actually happens is, you know, half the teams go home immediately, and 75% of them go home before the end of the first weekend. So it's really not as prolonged as it sounds for the teams involved. Most people go home right away, and only a lucky few will get to stay in the state of Indiana and keep playing.
Yeah, but, you know, logistically, when you think about it, from who's putting this together, you know, you get four teams at a site for the first two rounds, and they all know. I mean, two of them are going to lose the first deal and probably go home, so they cancel their hotel reservation for one night or something. But here you've got, we don't know if these guys are going to be here for 5 more days, 10 more days, or they're going home tonight.
Yeah, you know, you bring up a good point that frankly I hadn't thought of before, and that is that playing it all at one site, I wonder if the teams who go this season might not prefer it, because for one thing, it streamlines everything. You don't have to say, oh my gosh, we won at the last second, you know, on a spectacular shot. Now we've got to scramble to get hotel rooms for our team and all of our fans in Boise, Idaho next weekend or wherever it happens to be. You know, you just stay put where you are, and who knows, maybe this inadvertently will provide a model for future tournaments. We'll see.
Well, I cover UC Davis basketball, which is Division I now in the Big West Conference, you know, one of the lesser conferences, if you will. And they qualified a couple of years ago for one of those first, and they went to Dayton and beat North Carolina A&T, I believe it was. And boom, right away they had to get down to Tulsa to play Kansas. So,
yes, that can be a challenge, definitely. So maybe this way is better. We'll find out.
Have they made any announcements at all about fans? Probably a little premature.
It is premature. What we've seen in the games that are happening so far is that parents and other, you know, close friends of the program in very small numbers are starting to pop up in the stands in a socially distanced manner. But these are still essentially empty arenas, and the main source of cheering and noise comes from the players on the bench. It's a different kind of experience, and yet it's strange how fast, you know, I watch this stuff for a living, how fast I've become accustomed to it.
Yeah.
I would think, you know, I would never be used to it, and the opposite is the case. It'll be jarring when the happy day comes and we see a full arena once again. But in the meantime, the safe assumption is that there will be very, very few or next to no fans in the building when the NCAA tournament is played.
Well, I covered a UC Davis men's game on December the 4th at UC Davis in a 7,800-seat arena. They put me up in the cheap seats. I mean, way up. The radio guy was about 20 feet away from me, and they, you know, both of us are usually down on the floor, and there was nobody else. There were all those silly cutouts, and there was this irritating crowd noise. It sounded like you got a cheap motel room near the ocean, and the ocean was constantly roaring, you know, and it was just, it didn't matter if it was a good call, a bad call, or the home team scored or the other team scored. It was just this din. It was very strange.
Yeah, I feel like this is a work in progress as far as programs mastering things like the cutouts of the fans and the degree of noise and what those noises should be. I think they're getting better at it as the season goes along, and I trust that we will have the opportunity this season only, I hope, to see some really creative things in the next few weeks. But right now, programs are just kind of scrambling and doing what they can.
I haven't seen anybody, though, with a cutout under the basket saying John 3:16.
Right.
Or where is like that?
A cutout of that guy with the rainbow wig that,
yeah, right,
you know, hold up John 3:16.
Right.
Or, you know, there's all kinds of things you could do with those cutouts to try and disconcert the opponent. we'll see if teams can get more creative as the weeks go by here.
Yeah, unfortunately, I have not been ever covered a game since December 4th because that was it. They haven't canceled the season, but they've missed 7 or 8 games now, including 4 league games. They're playing Friday, Saturday against the same opponent, gym, you know, so there's no travel and all that instead of the Thursday, Saturday, and you're paying, you know, you have a traveling partner and all that stuff. And a lot of conferences, are doing that.
UC Davis can thank their lucky stars. At least they're not league rival Hawaii that has faced a real challenge during this pandemic. They've played 2 games locally, both against, you know, of course, Hawaii is the only Division I team within 2,500 miles of Hawaii.
Right.
They are coming to the mainland this weekend. I think UC Riverside is who they play. And that will be their first Division I competition. So
if they get to play it.
The pandemic has raised challenges, and to the degree that we're getting any basketball at all, we are fortunate.
Yeah. In fact, like I said, the Big West that I cover, the Northridge women's team dropped the sport before the season when 6 players said they weren't going to play. The UC San Diego just scrubbed for the foreseeable future. And even, you know, Coach K, a week or two ago, after a loss, of course, said, what are we doing? Should we even be playing? You know, so.
Right. On the men's side, the Ivies, mm-hmm. they have said no thank you to basketball this year. Bethune-Cookman, I know, has shut it down for this year. And another program that I'm not remembering right now. So there have been a few that have made that choice. And, you know, that's completely their prerogative. And I'm not one to say.
Yeah, well, it's
a little later on and say, wow, that was the thing to do. So very much a fingers crossed situation, not a boy, we've got this all figured out.
Yeah, especially with right now with Los Angeles just on fire. That could wipe out a lot of the Pac-12 and the Big West and the West Coast Conference, and you know, there's a lot at stake there. I can say this though, since your book is about Catholic schools, Gonzaga looks awfully good.
Yeah, my agent has pointed out that it wouldn't be altogether a bad thing if Gonzaga won the national championship and went undefeated, the first college basketball team to do so in 45 years. That would be kind of a big story that might carry along a little tome about Catholic basketball rather well. So,
yeah, you know, it's not like Spokane. I mean, Spokane's a lovely city, but it's not like the garden spot of the West Coast. You know, it gets cold in the winter and snows, and it's,
you know, 25 years ago, they were considering, you know, reclassifying out of Division I. I mean, it's not only is it a remarkable story, but good luck trying to find the closest parallel. I mean, if you point to, you know, this Cinderella story or that one, I don't know of any other example where there's been such a spectacular ascent for so long that's been so consistent that started at such an overlooked level. Gonzaga wrote that book, and it's been an incredible journey for them.
Yeah, it's I say that to my wife every day. I say, how do they convince these kids to come to Spokane, you know?
And
I can see kids from maybe Seattle or Portland or Idaho somewhere, you know, but my goodness, especially this year, I mean, they've been playing a dynamite schedule and just creaming people.
Yes, and the interesting thing in terms of the talent they get is that their origin story correctly notes that, you know, in the beginning they were scouring the globe for international talent because they had to. So they were pulling in these great players. They got on board that trend before much of the rest of Division I. Now the irony is, you know, those international players are rubbing elbows. If you've been following Gonzaga this year, they've got a guy named Jalen Suggs, who, if he wants to, he can go directly into the NBA after this year as a one and done.
Yep.
They don't need to scour the globe anymore, but they still do. They still get great international players, and they're getting the top, you know, recruits from the U.S. So it's just a mighty combination, and they've just gotten better and better over time.
So where's Suggs from?
Suggs is from Minnesota, and he was quite a football player too. This is the level that Gonzaga is at now. Is that everybody wants Suggs, and Gonzaga, you know, won against, you know, they were fighting against, you know, Duke, Kentucky, Kansas, you name it.
Right.
And Suggs says, no, I want to go to the small Catholic school in Spokane, Washington.
Boy.
You know, the versions of ourselves from 25 years ago are rubbing our eyes saying, what is going on with that? But this is where Gonzaga basketball is at, and this is the reality today. They're the number one in the nation, undefeated, and it looks like they might run the table.
I've been lucky to cover two games there, and one not last year because that got canceled, but it was last year, but it was early. It was late November. I was up there covering a football playoff game in Cheney, Eastern Washington, and saw that Gonzaga was playing that night, and the football game was in the afternoon. And I called the SID at Gonzaga. He says, sure, come on over. We'd love to have you. It was great. The place just goes nuts.
Excellent. Any chance you get to see the Zags in the kennel in Spokane, you've got to do it.
So is this your first book?
This is my first published book. For graduate school, I had to write a much larger piece, but my father is the only one who read cover to cover. But yeah, this is my first published work, and I'm very excited to have the opportunity and to have such a good story to tell, which the whole idea for the book was frankly my agent's, and my first reaction was, well, surely that's been written up before. It's, you know, everybody knows, you know, Catholic schools love college basketball, and I found to my surprise that it really hadn't been, at least not as a book. So I jumped on it, and here we are.
Boy, that's great. The book is Miracles on the Hardwood, The Hope and a Prayer Story of a Winning Tradition in Catholic College Basketball by John Gassaway. You could have called it A Hoop and a Prayer.
Yeah. If only maybe we could still change the cover.
You could change the cover. Just give me credit inside somewhere.
Yeah.
So
I'll think about it.
So, I go back all the way to, believe it or not, having my heart broken by USF in the mid-50s. Not that I didn't like that basketball team enormously, but I grew up an Oregon State Beaver fan. And they lost by 1 point in the regional final in Corvallis. And USF goes on and wins the whole thing.
Yes, and the strange thing about Oregon State in terms of what USF was used to seeing in what turned out to be a national championship year for the Dons was Oregon State had a player who towered over Bill Russell.
Swede Hallbrook,
very good.
7'3".
He was listed at 7'3", and an Associated Press photographer. And this game, in the entire regional, was played on Oregon State's home court in Corvallis.
Right.
And AP photographer thought, well, this will be a good photo. We'll get 7'3" Swede Hallbrook together with near 6'10" Bill Russell. And the photographer told Hallbrook, just hold the ball as high as you can. And then he said to Bill Russell, the idea was Russell would be seen reaching for it in vain.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Bill, just come as close as you can. Russell was able to grab his half of the ball.
No wow.
He had such a wingspan, and I'm not sure there was even the term wingspan in the 1950s. But at the time, he said his wingspan had never been measured. And part of why Bill Russell changed college basketball was his drive and his talent, but a not insignificant portion was that telescopic wingspan of his. He was easily the most dominant college basketball player to that time, and some might say to any time up to Lou Alcindor, who later became Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Right.
But, sorry about what the Dons did to the Beavers that year, but that was a special era for for USF.
Yeah, and we just lost Casey Jones, didn't we?
Yes. Just a few days ago, and he was a tremendous defender. He was also from the Bay Area, like Bill Russell, a much more celebrated high school player, and he admitted that he had never heard of Bill Russell.
Oh, really?
That's how overlooked Russell was as a high school player.
Was Russell from McClymonds, or where was he from?
Exactly, from McClymonds. Okay. Very good, McClymonds in Oakland, but he was 6'7". When he arrived at San Francisco back then, freshmen couldn't play. So he debuted as a sophomore, and everybody asked the San Francisco coach, a gentleman by the name of Phil Wolpert, what's your secret? You know, how did you develop this Bill Russell kid so well and his skills? And he said, under my coaching, Bill Russell grew from 6'7" to 6'10". Now you understand what coaching genius is.
That's great. And USF now has I covered a game at USF last about November, not this previous year that got canceled, but and into the gym here walks Bill Cartwright.
Another USF legend. Yeah.
Another legend from Elk Grove High School, and right here in Sacramento area. After the game, it was right during Christmas break, but it was before Christmas, and interviewed the young USF coach after the game, and he had his little boy with him, who was kind of holding him, is maybe 2-3 years old, while I was interviewing. It wasn't in a press room or anything, we were just on the court, and we concluded it, and I said, is Santa coming? And Coach looked at me and says, we're Jewish.
Todd Golden is one of the bright young minds in the game.
Yeah.
He's going places, and I'm not just saying that because he contributed a very nice blurb on how good the book is.
Oh, did he? Oh, that's wonderful.
To the back of the book jacket. But that meant a lot to have the current coach of San Francisco do that for a book that rightly devotes a good portion of its contents to the great San Francisco teams in the 1950s.
Yeah, John, you spent time in Sacramento.
I am a former Sacramento resident. Our eldest son was born in Sacramento there at UC Davis Med Center.
Oh, I had two born there. Yeah.
Yeah, we were in Southland Park. We could walk to the zoo there, and
we really
loved it. Yeah, absolutely loved it.
Fairy tale town and all that.
Yeah, Thunderland, I believe.
And well, Thunderland and fairy tale town is kind of on the other side of the park.
Yeah. But we loved Sacramento. We would love to get back. We just had a great time there, and many great memories.
And you were at St. Robert Parish?
Yeah, that's right, just off of Freeport.
Yeah. How wonderful. So of all these, is Holy Cross the first one that won, a Catholic school that won a national championship?
Yeah, I mean, define national championship. They were the first
NCAA, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, they were the first one to win an NCAA tournament. Yeah. In the NIT-NCAA era, the first Catholic team to win a national tournament was St. John's. They were back-to-back champions, actually, of the NIT during the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
DePaul actually also got an NIT title with George Mikan. But yes, Holy Cross with Bob Cousy was the first Catholic team to win the NCAA title. And one of the great things I learned and found in researching this book was even tiny Holy Cross, which, you know, there are many basketball fans today who have probably never even heard of Holy Cross.
Sure.
At the time, that was a big, mean, scary East Coast team.
Mm-hmm.
they traveled west to play a very good St. Louis University team. The St. Louis newspaper was saying, back east, you know, they think Holy Cross is so great, but we prove that we really know basketball. They were what Georgetown and Gonzaga would be to later generations of fans, tiny Holy Cross. But they were national champions in 1947 with Bob Cousy.
Wow. I remember when Al McGuire, and I don't remember the year when he said, we're not, the heck with NCAA, we're going to the NIT.
Good memory. Yeah, he did that in 1970, and he made a big. He was unhappy with where the NCAA had bracketed his mm-hmm. team. They were good. They were in the top 10, and he was very upset and convinced the administration there that this was the right thing to do, and went to the NIT. And then in the opening minutes of their first round game at the NIT, they were losing, and they were just getting cut to ribbons by this player he'd never heard of. They were playing the University of Massachusetts. Mm. They called timeout. He started screaming at his assistant coach. He said, who the heck is that kid out there? And it was Julius Erving.
I was going to say, let me guess, Julius Erving. Oh, man. The first NCAA champion, being an Oregon State fan, this one, I remember at the University of Oregon in 1939, the Tall Firs.
Tall Firs, yeah, you bet.
And one day we were coming back from a trip up near Spokane, a place called Priest Lake, and we were driving through this little logging town of Oak Ridge in Oregon, and my dad was a botanist. And he saw this flower garden in front of one of these houses. And the guy was out working. An old man was out working in the flower garden. And he says, I got to stop and talk to him. So we stop. I get out of the car. And we start talking. And my dad calls me over. And he says, you got to meet this guy. I was probably 7 or 8 years old. And his name was Laddie Gale. And he was one of the Tall Firs. And just happened to retire and was living. It was probably in the late 60s, early 60s, something like that. And there he was in Oak Ridge. And so I've been kind of fond of the Tall Firs ever since.
Yeah, small world. Yeah. Interestingly, they didn't call it the Final Four back then. In
sure.
fact, you know, they didn't even have four teams in the same place back then. But it is true that in the 1939 NCAA tournament semifinals, Villanova did make it that far, making them the first Catholic team to reach what we would today call a Final Four. So they kind of began and so far ended the Catholic preeminence in the NCAA tournament when they won it all in 2018.
And of course, we all remember Loyola Chicago ending Cincinnati's in the Big O's streak of two in a row, which would have been three except for. Loyola, I think that was an overtime game.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. Good memory. It's amazing how the participants hold on to grudges and remember every play. There was a very controversial play near the end of regulation that went Loyola's way that allowed them to tie the game, and eventually they went on to win it in overtime. Mm-hmm. But when one of the Cincinnati players was contacted for the 50th anniversary of the game, he was saying that they should have had three in a row, and the officials were from Chicago. this just isn't right. He was still mad 50 years later, but that was a remarkable Loyola Chicago team in 1963, led by Jerry Harkness, and they scored a lot of points, and Cincinnati was a great team.
Oh, yeah.
Those were the two best teams that year, and Loyola Chicago prevailed.
In fact, if I'm recalling correctly, Cincinnati beat my Beavers in the semis.
Yes.
And Terry Baker.
They swamped them, yeah. And Loyola Chicago outscored Duke in the other semifinal. That was the first time Duke had ever made it to a Final Four.
I remember watching that game, and I've thrown this trivia question out in my newspaper column and on the radio many times: who's the only guy to win the Heisman Trophy and play in the Final Four? And everybody guesses Charlie Ward, and it's Terry Baker. And I remember watching that game against Cincinnati, and was fond of the Big O and all that. But it was they're playing Oregon State. And they just picked our pockets. It was like it was like night and day. They were so much faster, and it was Terry Baker was, as a basketball player, was slow and plodding, and it was a regular Boy Scout. He was a good shot when he got open, but he didn't have that speed, that quickness, that leaping ability.
Now, Cincinnati had an amazing run. They came within an eyelash of winning three consecutive tournaments. And a lot of time credit is given, rightfully so, to teams like San Francisco and to Loyola Chicago for, in the case of San Francisco, playing three black players as early as the 1950s, or for Loyola Chicago, playing four as early as the 1960s. But give due credit to Cincinnati, which also had four black players, and it was an important moment for college basketball. Of course, Texas Western.
I was going to say Texas Western did that too, didn't they?
With five black players against an all-white Kentucky team coached by Adolph Rupp.
But, right.
Loyola Chicago was an important step along that path, and Cincinnati was very much right there with them.
Yeah, you know, it's just it's funny because one of the great coaches early on, Ev Shelton, I got to know him when he was coaching at Sacramento State.
Really?
Yeah, he coached Wyoming to the championship in 43. And then ended up at Sac State for a number of years. I'm not quite sure how he ended up at Sac State, but this would have been late 60s, probably.
My goodness, he must have been rather old by that point.
Yeah, I remember him as an older gentleman, with emphasis on the word gentleman. And and I remember one time I was at Spanger's, the great restaurant, the great seafood restaurant down in Berkeley, and sat down in a booth with one of my daughters, and we're ordering, and there's a few pictures, you know, old stuff around there, and it says, "You are sitting in the Pete Newell booth."
Oh, my.
And there was a picture of Pete. Yeah.
Of course, he was at San Francisco himself.
That's right.
Moved on to Cal, but by way of Michigan State. So he did a little bit of everything, but Newell was a name that Bob Knight, for one, mentioned frequently as a big early influence on his coaching career. And during the season where San Francisco eventually went undefeated, their second national championship year, they played at Berkeley, and Newell had his team hold the ball, and the score was ridiculously low, and fans were irate. The game was actually televised because fan interest was so high, and they saw a very boring game with Cal holding the ball for their trouble, and the Bay Area press was just in an uproar, and they said, "We need a shot clock in this game." People were really upset about that.
I remember one year when Oregon State was pretty good. I'm thinking it was before Ralph Miller, but I'm not sure because there weren't too many good teams between Slatsgill and Ralph Miller. But they went back east to play St. John's, who was pretty powerful at the time. And I came home. I couldn't see the game. They weren't televising the game, and couldn't get it on the radio in the daytime in California, and my dad's sitting there, and I said, "How'd we do?" And he says, "We only scored 22 points." And I said, "You're kidding me." And he said, "St. John's scored 8. And St. John's had done the same thing. They had just took the air out of the ball before there was a shot clock. When did the shot clock come in?
Incredibly, the shot clock did not come in for all college games, including, most crucially, NCAA tournament games, until 1985-86.
Oh, so it could have been Ralph Miller's years.
Famously, Villanova played a very deliberate style in winning the 1985 NCAA title and shocking number one-ranked Georgetown in the process. And that there were a lot of games in the early and mid-'80s that were down in the 50s or even the 40s in NCAA tournament time. And eventually, college coaches who had opposed it for years and years and years, the NBA, of course, had a shot clock as far back as the 1950s. Finally, after all these games in the 40s, at the most important time of the year when the sport was trying to sell itself, they said okay, and we've never looked back.
Yeah, it's just I'll have to look that up and be sure I have that score right. But I'm pretty sure 22-8 was what it was. I think it may have been one of those years where Miller had a really high ranked team, and people figured that's the only way to get him. The coaches tend to be purists. They tend to be the last ones to want to do a shot clock. I remember Bob Hamilton at UC Davis, who was a superstar up at Oregon, when they went to the three-point shot, he wouldn't even let his guys try threes during the game.
Yeah.
You know, just like, let's give them 4 points for a half court, you know.
Yeah, exactly. There are some great quotes that I came across from coaches opposing the three-point shot. And, in fact, I didn't even have room for all of them. There was one coach, I think he was at TCU, who said, if there's a three-point shot, you'll find me on such and such a bridge, and such a river, and that's where I'm going to throw myself in. I mean, that's how adamantly this thing was opposed. And, of course, now we don't even give it a second play. It's been great. It's opened up space under the basket. You know, we're no longer dominated so totally by big guys like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Bill Walton. It makes a star out of guys who are the same size as us, like Steph Curry or who have you. So it's been a great thing, but like all great things, it's opposed when it's introduced.
Well, the only time I don't like it is when my team's ahead by 10 with a minute to go.
You know, exactly.
I don't even like a 2-point shot then.
Then it's bad. Agreed.
Well, John, I could talk to you all day. I sure hope we can get you back on the program. The book is Miracles on the Hardwood, The Hope and a Prayer Story of a Winning Tradition in Catholic College Basketball. The author is John Gassaway, Gassaway. How can people get this? Order it from Amazon?
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere that you prefer to buy your books, it'll be there.
Boy, I can't wait. Cannot wait. It'll be a St. Patrick's Day present.
Exactly.
John, thanks so much. I hope our paths cross again soon. God's blessings to you and your family.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks, John. Take care. That's John Gassaway. Wow. That was a lot of fun, Gabe. I'm not supposed to have that much fun. We'll take a break. Back with more on the Bishop's Hour right after this. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Drop by and shop at their thrift store, a beautiful, beautiful thrift store at 2275 Watt Avenue. Open Mondays through Saturdays from 10 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to 6. They also accept donations at the store, donations of furniture, appliances, clothing, books, everyday household items. Your donations help to fund the many projects of the St. Vincent de Paul Society throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Do such wonderful, wonderful work, and the thrift store is one of the ways they raise the funds to help people throughout the diocese, and also many of their clients are able to access the thrift store for items that they need. You can give them a call. They will come pick it up as well, but you can give them a call. They're at 916-972-1212. And remember, again, the thrift store is open 7 days a week at 2275 Watt Avenue right here in Sacramento. Well, Bishop Soto refers to Christ the King Retreat Center as the jewel of the diocese, and indeed it is. What a beautiful oasis it is. It's located in Citrus Heights, right in the hustle and bustle of the city, and you feel like you're getting away from it all when you turn off the main road and just come into Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center. Christ the King has served Northern California and the Diocese of Sacramento for over 60 years through parish weekend retreats, individual spiritual direction, and a variety of other programs. For information on all the programs that they offer, including residential programs, give them a call. They're at 916-725-4720, or you can visit them at 6520 Van Maren Lane in Citrus Heights. And we certainly thank the St. Vincent de Paul Society and Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour.
This is Bishop William K. Wiegand, the Bishop Emeritus of Sacramento, and you're listening to the Bishop's Hour with Bob Denning.
Thank you, Bishop Wiegand, for that wonderful introduction. Thanks for all you do for our wonderful Diocese of Sacramento in so many ways, and have done for years. Well, Moises De Leon joins us. Appreciate you taking the time to be with us. A lot on your plate right now.
No worries. It's great to be on the radio.
Yeah, great to have you with us. Tell us a lot coming up here in the next week. Protect Every Life, Journey with Us, January 11th through the 23rd. So beginning this today, yeah.
Yeah, so starting today, we're having workshops or talks regarding human dignity. So we wanted to really capture the whole aspect of what is human dignity and how that plays an important role in our respect life issues. And then leading with that, we're expecting on Wednesday to have someone come in and talk about transforming hearts and having more of a dialogue of how can we approach the industry of abortion and how can we provide a culture of actually of healing and actually providing, fostering love with our mothers in need. Because many of the times when it comes to any aspects of choosing life, there's a lot of other issues that affect what we are, or the mothers choose to do. So one of the things that we're trying to provide is provide that context of what's happening in that period of time with our mothers. And that's one of the things that the U.S. bishops have pushed on is mothers in need or walking with moms. And we've adapted it here in our diocese as well, just to having a conversation about mothers connecting our family, friends, parishes to clinics that have maternity homes and places where there's options to choose life, and there's ways of going through the process and not being alone.
Moises is the Associate Director of Respect Life Ministry here in the Diocese of Sacramento. So much happening around life issues. Of course, the unfortunate anniversary of the Roe v. Wade is coming up on January 22nd, and there will be a special mass at the Cathedral of the Blessed Sacrament, live streamed with Bishop Soto, beginning at noon on the 22nd.
Correct, correct. And we're asking everyone to actually, if they could actually follow us on Facebook, that way they get the reminders of when Mass is going to start and all the events that we have as well.
Very good. And the Respect Life Novena, starting January 14, running through January 22, what all does that involve?
So what's entitled in the Novena / walk is having a time of prayer and reflection and each day there's a particular intention. So it's trying to create a culture of prayer, something that Bishop has been trying to push in the past year or so, is providing that culture of prayer using our Young Saints cards that he mentioned that we'll be distributing soon. And that's part of one of the things that comes in the Respect Life package or prayer packages, having those cards be a way of motivating young men and women, the youth, that there's saints of all different ages that have dedicated their lives to God. And the part of the prayer walk is, in the Novena, is trying to create that environment of prayer at home. With the whole shelter in place, everyone's at home, but if they want to walk around their neighborhoods, to the park, they could do it in a solidarity of prayer through the Respect Life Novena as well, trying to create some kind of unity and solidarity as a whole, because as we all know, we have the Walk for Life, both the March for Life in D.C. and Walk for Life here in San Francisco, but if one cannot attend either of those, and because of COVID, we're suggesting this option to be a way of being connected with all those people that are going to be doing those in D.C. and SF, but here locally providing that awareness of we can be in solidarity with each other.
Yeah, and, you know, with COVID, I understand just today that the Walk for Life has canceled the rally portion of their event. They will still have the walk, but they will not be having the rally, which is generally about an hour and a half, and the crowd all crammed together and, you know, speakers, et cetera, and they've just decided that probably wasn't a prudent thing to do.
Yeah, so that's why we're trying to promote something.
Yeah, and I think it's really a great idea, and it'll have a lot of people participating here in the Diocese of Sacramento. That all these local events a way to really be in solidarity.
And each day of the novena, it's going to be posted on our social media, Facebook, mm-hmm. around 10:30.
Okay.
So if anyone who wants to join, they can still register right now. So registration is free. We give an option if they want to donate a small amount or a big amount to our local moms in need. They also, that will include also people donating will receive a Respect Life mask, which does protect every life. But if they just want to register for the novena, it's free. That way they can get the prayer novena packet. They get the prayer cards and everything. So they could join us every day, starting on the 14th at 10:30 a.m. on our social media. And then on the 23rd, which is our walk, solidarity walk, we're asking everyone from 10:30 and onward, we're going to be posting a local walk. Each of our members of our team here at the office will be doing part of the prayer. A little rosary, testimony of a mother, and an ultrasound, and then we're promoting a walk throughout the whole day if people can go on a walk.
Very good. And if you go to scd.org/protect-every-life, Moises, how can people donate to this?
So going to that website, there is a link where they could go and donate, and that's part of the registration. So the registration on that page is also a donation. There's an option for donation on that same registration form. And that's how they could donate. If they don't really want to get a mask, they could just donate an X amount to our mother's maternity homes, Bishop Cayo's or Mother Teresa, the Gable Project, and also to Sacramento Life Center as well.
Right, right. All just great and worthy charities throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. So they've just, when you think about all the lives they've saved and all the lives they've changed, it's just remarkable. The Sacramento Life Center has been, actually predates Roe v. Wade, the Gabriel Project, Bishop Bayo's Maternity Home here in Sacramento, and the Mother Teresa Maternity Home in Placerville. So those are wonderful, wonderful organizations. Well, Moises, keep fighting the good fight. We need you out there in the vineyard. Thanks so much for joining us, and God's blessings to you and your family in the new year.
No, thank you, Bob. Happy New Year's, and blessings to all.
Yeah, thanks, Moises. That's Moises De Leon, Associate Director of Respect Life Ministry here in the Diocese of Sacramento. This is a statement from Bishop Soto about COVID-19 vaccines, and you can be assured that they are morally acceptable here in, according to the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, the California Catholic Conference, which representing all the bishops of California and also here in the Diocese of Sacramento. The bishops writes, when considering a vaccine, one should review its safety and effectiveness, as well as any possible health concerns such as allergies. Bishop Soto, in unison with his brother bishops in California, presents the following important moral considerations as well. Mindful of the Church's moral teaching, he encourages Catholics to receive a safe and effective COVID-19 vaccine for the sake of oneself and loved ones and the common good. The statement goes on, as the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines against COVID-19 become available, it is critically important that Catholics and others have an accurate understanding of how these vaccines may be viewed from the perspective of Catholic moral teaching and tradition. The Vatican's Doctrinal Office, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, has determined that it is morally acceptable, those are their words, for Catholics to take these vaccines against the COVID-19 virus. Their determination is deeply rooted in the Catholic moral tradition. A brief review of their document is in reaching this determination will assist people as they consider use of these vaccines, these and other vaccines. Vaccine development and production over the last several decades has often relied upon some cell lines that lamentably were originally developed from cells obtained from two fetuses that were aborted in the 70s and 80s. The Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are not dependent on these cell lines. They were developed using different technology relying on ribonucleic acid, that's RNA, from the virus itself. Even though the vaccines may have been tested using compromised cell lines, this does not establish a connection between the vaccine recipient and the abortion. Consequently, use of these vaccines is ethically sound. Other vaccines in development, including AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson, have been developed from compromised cell lines. The specific moral questions are whether a recipient of these COVID-19 vaccines developed from such cell lines is morally complicit in the original abortions, and whether use of the vaccine will lead others to have abortions. According to Catholic moral teaching and tradition, it is morally unacceptable for an individual or institution to contribute to and influence an immoral act committed by another in a way that shows they approve or intend the immoral act. It is also wrong for them to contribute components that are essential to the immoral act, even if they do not intend the act of the other, and to lead others by example to engage in an immoral act. Since it is impossible to influence an act that occurred in the past, a recipient of the COVID-19 vaccines developed from cell lines in question cannot influence or contribute to anything regarding the original abortions. Again, the mere fact that a vaccine may have been tested using these cell lines does not establish a connection between the vaccine recipient and the abortion. Furthermore, simply knowing the origin of the cell lines does not mean that one intends abortion. Thus, a recipient of the vaccine does not approve of or intend the original abortions or materially contribute to them. Clearly, all that the recipient intends is the good, preventing disease and saving lives. This includes protecting countless pregnant women from contracting COVID-19 who will be able to carry their unborn babies safely to term. The act of receiving the COVID-9 vaccines developed from the cell lines in question does not lead others to procure abortion. The action of the recipient is not the reason why someone has an abortion, nor is it an endorsement of abortion. Furthermore, vaccine researchers and others who develop cell lines from abortion-derived cells or use such cell lines in research do not lead persons to procure abortions. Researchers who develop or use these types of cell lines do so because they either see no connection of their work to abortion, and or because of the success of the cell line for research to develop effective and safe vaccines. On December 21, 2020, the Vatican's Doctrinal Office, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, issued a statement noting it is morally acceptable for Catholics to take vaccines against COVID-19. Among other things, the CDF stated, quote, all vaccinations recognized as clinically safe and effective can be used in good conscience with a certain knowledge that the use of such vaccines does not constitute formal cooperation with the abortion from which the cells used in production of the vaccines derive. The morality of vaccination depends not only on the duty to protect one's own health, but also on the duty to pursue the common good. That's the end of the quote. No more quote here. In the absence of other means to stop or even prevent the epidemic, the common good may recommend vaccination, especially to protect the weakest and most exposed. And that's the end of the quote. If some of the faithful choose not to take the vaccine for reasons of conscience, the Vatican says those persons must do their utmost to avoid becoming vehicles for the transmission of infectious agents. The Bishop Soto adds, I hope these reflections are helpful. Our commitment to the health and dignity of each human life compels us to be vigilant about the moral implications of medical technological developments, as well as taking the necessary personal precautions, including the vaccine, to protect and care for one another. We rely on the intercession of our Blessed Mother Mary so that we may be guided by the wisdom and mercy of her Son, Jesus. So respectfully, Bishop Jaime Soto. So you can rest assured that it is morally acceptable. It's been studied really extensively by people that know about the vaccine, know about its development, and also know Catholic teaching.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm just waiting in line, Gabe.
Are you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's.
That's how much you care about the bishops are. You come out of line and maybe miss your spot to come here and record. Yeah.
No, it is interesting how different it has been. There's no question the rollout has been slow. A lot of vaccine has arrived, but not too many people have been vaccinated yet. There seems to be some confusion. Hopefully that they'll get those things ironed out and they'll have a sort of an orderly process and where everybody who wants to be vaccinated. Oh, there is a fair amount of resistance to getting the vaccine. I don't know the percentage, probably 15-20% of the population, something like that. Sometimes on moral grounds, more likely people just they don't trust medical science, or they,
I think it's scary. I mean, you know, it's something that no one's ever really necessarily gotten. So, you know, it's kind of like when you see penguins, you know, the penguins will go on the edge of a cliff to go look down in the water, yeah, and they want to go eat. And then the way that they get one penguin to find out whether or not they're seals in there, they one tosses a penguin in. So he pushes one of the penguins in. If he doesn't get eaten, then they're good to go.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of people who are like, I want to get it, but I just, you know, they're concerned. Yeah. I mean, and it's understandable, but I think that, like, you know, you got to go with what you're, how you feel.
The one thing that calms me about safety,
mm-hmm,
is that the medical professionals are lining up to get it.
Right. You
know,
exactly.
And they know a heck of a lot more about, I mean, when they start using all these big terms and how the vaccine was developed, you know,
right,
not the abortion related part, but just they use a lot of big scientific terms about what it is.
Correct.
And how the antibodies are developed and how it will work in the body and all that. They know what they're putting into their arms.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
And it seems almost universal amongst not completely, but pretty close.
And they all know the stakes of the idea that everyone keeps saying, like, maybe we shouldn't get them done first because if something does go wrong, then we have no medical professionals. They all understand that as well. And I think that the fact that they're all lining up to do it is one of those things where they're trusting their vocation to the idea that they're getting it done.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah.
And you have to realize that. Most of these vaccines have had two or three phases of trials involving 30,000 people, involving 60,000 people, things like that, and very minor side effects.
Anything you put in your body is going to have a side effect to it.
Yeah,
even aspirin. I mean, you're going to have a side effect.
You can say, well, yeah, but they don't know what it's going to be like 10 years down the road or 20 years. Well, maybe they don't. But with most, you know, I mean, I was... we were the guinea pigs for the Salk vaccine,
mm-hmm,
when I was growing up, and you know, there were some blips on the radar in the early going. They fixed them, and it literally eradicated polio, which was scared the dickens out of everybody.
Well, as much as everyone is, we all are very different and diverse. Different in a lot of ways. The diversity of human beings is pretty astounding, and not everyone's going to react exactly the same way.
Oh, no. But I mean, there are some people that have had severe reactions.
Yeah.
That's why they tell you we want to watch you for 15 minutes or half an hour or something like that, so that we're sure there's not, you know, other than a sore arm. I just talked to a doc today who had gotten the first shot, and he said, yeah, he said I had to ask him if they had given me the shot.
Didn't hurt?
It didn't hurt at all. And they said, but about 3 or 4 days later, he said my shoulder, you know, got kind of sore. But I mean, that's pretty common with vaccinations.
I think the most important thing is that whether people get it or they don't get it, just everyone be respectful of each other.
Exactly.
That's the most important part of it.
Exactly.
If your neighbor refuses to get it, then, you know, don't go don't go, you know, yelling shame at them or anything like that.
Everybody be careful. And we're seeing that certainly with mass attendance or not attendance, you know, we're being very respectful here in the Diocese of Sacramento. So that's going to do it for us for today. Thanks for listening. God bless.
I was sure by now, God, you would have reached down and wiped our tears away, stepped in and saved the day. But once again, I say amen, and it's still raining. But as the thunder rolls, I barely hear you whisper through the rain, I'm with you. And as your mercy falls, I'll raise my hands and praise the God who gives and takes away.